G'day, I'm Osher Ginsburg.
And I'm Charlie Clawson.
We are two dads who, when we found out we were going to be dads, went looking for a podcast that could help us navigate what it means to be a dad in the modern world.
I mean, there were parenting podcasts, but they all seemed to be aimed at mums, or at the very least, mums and dads.
Yeah, there were no podcasts for dads specifically, and certainly not dads who want to be hands-on and do their share of raising their children.
So, we started Dad Pod, a podcast by dads, for dads who don't want to be shit dads.
Each week we share our own stories from the good and the bad to the thermonuclear tantrums, as well as talk with some of the biggest experts in the field to help all of us become better dads.
So if you're a dad, a mum dad, or a dad-to-be, search Dad Pod where you get your podcasts.
The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week is Guy Davis. You know him as the Sultan of Cinema, the Pharaoh of the flicks, and he's back once again to talk all things movies. Guy was the one who's floated the topic because I have no imagination, and I've been trying to think of a way, like a title, to how we could frame the discussion. And I thought we could call this the rearview mirror episode, because you know how objects in the rearview mirror may appear bigger than they are. Well, we want to talk about filmmakers and actors that we thought were going to be bigger, but for whatever reason, their careers did not pan out in the way that you and I, with our astute observations, thought they would. I mean, a little caveat, it should be stated that I met both Chris Hemsworth and Margot Robbie in their very early days as actors, and I dismissed both of them as having no future in the business. So,
oh, for real?
When it comes to picking talent, I am the last guy who should be talking. We want to discuss actors and filmmakers that we were captured by, that we just waited to see what would happen with them. So we can dive into it. I wanted to give an honorable mention first up, because this guy has actually had a pretty good career. If you look at his IMDb credits, you know, he's done over like 150 projects. The actor Tom Wilson from the Back to the Future series, Biff Tannen, of course.
Of course,
now,
yeah.
The reason I want to bring him up is that when you look at his IMDb, like you think about Back to the Future, like probably the biggest film of 1984 or whenever it came out, 1985. A huge hit around the world, you know, instant star for Michael J. Fox if he wasn't already a huge star from Family Ties. Mm. But the real MVP, I think, in that film is Tom Wilson. Like what he does with Biff Tannen, and just one of the most hissable villains. Like even now when I see Back to the Future, the moment where George McFly knocks out Biff is still one of the greatest, most heart-pounding moments of triumph. The nerd's
it's real stand-up and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and he also, you know, he plays middle-aged Biff and he plays teenage Biff, and he does it all with such a kind of like charisma and aplomb, like really kind of scenery-chewing kind of villain. But he did not work within the following year. He did April Fool's Day was the only film he did in the 12 months following Back to the Future. I was flabbergasted by that.
Is it possible, Charlie, that he was just too good at being bad? And you sort of looked at him and go,
oh, you mean like
not sure what this
around.
Not even that. He was just so convincing as this pushy, arrogant, bullying asshole that people are like, oh, God, there's got to be some touch of reality in that. It's, you know, he can't be that good an actor at, you know, and playing such a bad, bad person. It's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, I got a little bit of a thrill maybe like 15 or so years later when he showed up on the great TV series Freaks and Geeks playing
and
this
Geeks,
PE
yeah.
teacher. Very, very apt casting on the part of Freaks and Geeks, casting Biff Tannen as a gym teacher, who actually turned out to be a really great guy who started dating the mum of one of the geeks, the geekiest of the geeks, actually, and tried really hard to forge a bond with this kid, even though they were complete polar opposites. It actually showed that Wilson had a bit of range to him. I mean, he probably displayed that he had range before that, but certainly to my eyes, it was like, you're right. We definitely underrated this guy. He should have been working a lot more than he did. Although, as you said, 150 credits or so on the IMDb page, it's nothing to be sniffed at, is it?
Mm.
I mean, actors like to work. Well, they like to work constantly. It is a job, after all.
But yeah, but it is sometimes like those villain roles, because generally, you know, the villain is more colourful and does get to chew the scenery a bit more. It can be a real star-making vehicle. You know, you think of like Ralph Fiennes in Schindler's List. And if you think about him over the course of that trilogy too, like when he plays Mad Dog Tannen in the third one, like it's like another completely different character. And, or, you know, even like the sort of foreshadowing of Donald Trump with, you know, in Back to the Future 2 when he's playing the casino boss. Like they're all quite different, really. And so he's got range. But I just wanted to read you this one thing because I grabbed this off his IMDb. You tell me, do you think Tom Wilson wrote his own bio on IMDb? Because it goes, Tom Wilson is a creative artist whose professional career has explored almost every imaginable artistic discipline, blending them into a unique and very individual declaration of life in the arts. A man of fervent but private faith his whole life, the last few years have been interesting with hundreds of invitations to speak at conferences and retreats, as well as the opportunity to record the music that he began playing in the church in the 1970s.
Okay, here's who wrote this. Tom Wilson's mum, Tom Wilson's partner, or Tom Wilson's pastor. When you see IMDb profiles like that, that are real testimonies, you know, and really, you may know this from their, you know, I'm a bit on the blacklist that time, but I'll tell you what, they've actually written like a couple of operas, and you know, they studied as a mime at the Sorbonne for a while, all this business. And you may also remember them shilling juice on that commercial. So, yeah, I find that hilarious when you see ones like that. But I think in Tom Wilson's, it may well be justified. One thing you were saying, though, about how villains have more flourishes, something that I think may have stopped Wilson from being bigger, and you're right that across the Back to the Future trilogy, he sort of played a variety of roles. But I think he's best known as 50-era Biff Tannen. And Biff is such a blunt instrument of a villain. He's not necessarily, you know, there are some villains that even when they're terrible, like you mentioned Ralph Fiennes, Schindler's List, going to aspire to be Eamon Goethe in Schindler's List, but Fiennes brings a kind of almost coolness to it. And also, it doesn't hurt that he looks like Ralph Fiennes. He's kind of handsome. Whereas, I think Tom Wilson is just, he's this big, blocky, blunt instrument of a person who would just, you know, give you the atomic wedgie. No one wants to be reminded of that. No one aspires to be. So, yeah, it speaks to a lack of imagination on casting directors' parts that they didn't, put him up for more stuff.
So Tom Wilson, he was my honourable mention, but let's start. Let's start with some filmmakers that that hit the scene hot, that we thought were going to have bigger careers. I want to start with Richard Kelly, Donnie Darko director Richard Kelly, who, again, is someone who hasn't had, like, a bad career. It's not like he made one film and disappeared. You know, he's worked with Tony Scott. You know, he's written some TV. He appears like he has another film in the works. But when you think about the cult following of Donnie Darko and the potential of where, you know, that could have gone, you know, maybe a Darren Aronofsky type career where he sort of keeps making art house films and then breaks through with a mainstream film. It never really happened. And I remember hearing an interview with him. He did Kevin Smith's podcast a while back, like maybe I'm thinking almost 8 or 9 years ago, I listened to it. And there was a real wistfulness when he was talking to Kevin Smith. And Kevin Smith is, you know, he's forged his own career away from being a filmmaker. He's now more of a kind of just like, I guess, an identity. But Richard Kelly, in talking to Kevin Smith and what Kevin Smith has done, you could sense there was this kind of like, I don't know if it was envy, but a wistfulness about, oh man, like you parlayed whatever little success you had with Clerks and that, you know, Askewniverse, and you've turned it into your own cottage industry. And I just got the feeling that maybe Richard Kelly thought, oh, I had a missed opportunity with the Darkoverse. I could have turned that into something.
It's true. Well, when you look at Donnie Darko, when you looked at Donnie Darko back 20-something years ago when it came, because it was 2000, wasn't it? Yeah, I think when it came out.
Was it? Yeah, right.
Yeah. Even at that early stage, and this was just sort of at the very origin of DVDs and special features and commentaries and all that, it was very apparent that he had stuff that extended out of the frame. He had a whole mythology about Donnie Darko and time travel and everything that sort of wove that story together. There was a whole lot going on, and you know, you had to, you know, sort of, you'd have to find Easter eggs on the DVD or Blu-ray to sort of know a bit more. Or there was stuff online that you, there were reams and reams of material that you could read. So yeah, I mean, this is a guy who's clearly not short of imagination and not short of ambition either. And sometimes, you know, the reach exceeds the grasp, I think, as we saw with his second film, Southland Tales, which, yeah, I think a lot of people saw that and went, okay, yeah, this we need to put some reins on this guy. We need to put some brakes on this guy, because you leave him to his own, you give him his druthers, and he just takes it and runs with it. And occasionally and you get something that's, I think I see what you're going for here, but I don't really understand it, and I'm not sure I like it.
It's funny with him. Like, I think Southland Tales is a mess. I know that there's been a bit of a movement lately to sort of look back at it fondly as some kind of, like, you know, undiscovered, you know, masterpiece. But I just think it, like you say, it's just someone who was given too much creative freedom, and it just goes in all different directions. And I think that's confirmed by the Blu-ray director's cut of Donnie Darko.
Oh, right, yeah.
Because you watch the director's cut, and it's much, much more, it is so much inferior to the studio cut. That doesn't often happen, but the musical choices, the scenes that they include, it's a worse cut. Like this, because apparently I think in the making of Donnie Darko, he did have some battle with the studios who didn't know what to make of the film, and so they insisted on the cut that went to theaters, and that is the better cut. But then obviously he got this big cult following, and people were probably blowing a bit of smoke. And so he was given greater freedom with Southland Tales, and that's the end result.
Yeah. Am I right in thinking that the director's cut of Donnie Darko, the first music cue, the one that runs over the opening credits, it's not Echo and the Bunnymen, it's something else?
Yeah, I think it's In Excess, Never Tear Us Apart. Or is that actually in the original?
I think
cut?
That might be over the party scene later. Yeah, I think they do throw in some In Excess. But I mean, I think one of the things that makes Richard Kelly Rich Kelly, or gives him his juice, is that opening sequence of Donnie Darko that kicks off with it's The Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen, which is it's one of the perfect meldings of music and, sorry, I'm going to put my wanky film critic beret on here, mise en scène. You know, it's it really sets the tone. You know, and it's such a great choice. And for Kelly to say, no, I don't think I like that, I think I want to change that, it's like, no, dude. That's one of the best choices in the movie. But I mean, looking at Donnie Darko, you're right. I mean, there's stuff in there that's so imaginative. I mean, that whole sequence, it's like, I think it's a one take thing, or if it's not literally one take, it's cut together so it feels like one take, where they're introducing into the school and the characters in the school, the teachers and the students and all that kind of stuff. And it's all done to Tears for Fears. And it's so well done. It's like, oh, wow, yeah, this guy's really got something. And, yeah, you wouldn't be surprised that people would just throw money at him or throw accolades at him and just say, do what you like, because, yeah, we trust you. Except trust is sometimes misplaced.
You feel like if Richard Kelly had made Donnie Darko in, say, you know, 2010, that he's the kind of director that Marvel would have snapped up and said, okay, go make Doctor Strange. Like, he has that indie sort of pedigree, which then you think a studio would like, well, we can boss this guy around. He's made one film. He'd be the Josh Trank.
Yeah.
He'd be the Josh Trank of 2010.
Let's not wish Josh Trankness on anyone. You would think that something like Southland Tales would, you know, kill a career stone dead, but he actually made another movie after that called The Box, this metaphysical sci-fi thriller starring Cameron Diaz and James Marsden. It's based on a short story by the great Richard Matheson. And the premise is you've got this couple that are sort of getting by, not quite, you know, things are a little bit tough. A stranger rocks up to the door with a box in his hand, says, a little red button on this box. If you press the little red button, $1 million in a case will arrive at your door. But somewhere in the world will drop dead because of what you've done. You don't know them, but they're dead regardless because of what you did. Well, I could use $1 million, but do I really want that on my conscience? And it's a good, tight sort of moral dilemma thriller, I think, on the page. And of course, our boy Kelly can't help himself. He throws in a whole bunch of weird shit at the end. So that may be the reason that no one's picking up at this stage what Mr. Kelly's putting down. It's like, oh, can we trust you not to throw in like strange water tentacles and kind of business? Because that seems to be one of his motifs. You see water tentacles in a lot of his stuff. So I don't know. I'm based on Donnie Darko alone, I'm pulling for the guy to make a comeback.
Well, it sort of feels like when you're a director who hits the scene like that, you go in two different directions. You either go the sort of Aronofsky, I'm going to keep making my art house type films for a while, or you've got to do the lily pad jump from increasingly bigger films to get to your studio film. But he, I don't think he didn't, Southland Tales and The Box, they weren't successful enough for him to adequately do that, but they were too big to be considered, you know, little art house films as well.
Yeah, I think that one of the bad things for Kelly is that he sort of he arrived on the scene just as prestige TV was happening, but he wasn't able to sort of take advantage of that. I mean, him at the helm of some show for like FX or not even one of the huge ones like HBO, but you put him in charge of a weird superhero project, something like maybe Legion. Did you ever see Legion?
Yeah, totally.
He'd be really good with something like that.
But, yeah, 100%. That's a really good call. Like, he should have been making Legion. It has shades of Donnie Darko all over it.
Doesn't it? Yeah. Now, shall I go with my first choice for looking in the rearview mirror?
Yeah.
It's a gentleman named Paul Brickman.
This is fascinating, this suggestion. Who was Paul Brickman, guy?
Now, children of the 80s will know Paul Brickman as the writer-director of Risky Business. You know, there was a time in the 80s when I was, you know, invited to teenage parties to watch movies and things like that. And sometimes, you know, you wouldn't want Up the Creek or, you know, your typical, what do you call them? Teenage boner comedy. You wanted something a little more, something with a higher thread count. And that's when it's like, should we watch Risky Business again, guys? That one never gets old. And it never does. It's such a great movie. I mean, not just a legitimately good teen sex comedy story or whatever.
Coming of age.
A legitimately good movie. Just so.
And so quotable. So many good quotes. Porsche. Like
Michael Mann made a sex comedy. Yeah.
And I remember because I first saw it on network TV, you know, back in the, for younger listeners out there, you know, back when you'd watch movies on like free to air and they'd put ads in. Yeah. And they obviously had
modified
for TV. And so the, you know, the key line of the entire film is sometimes you got to say, what the fuck, which they would change to sometimes you got to say, what the hell? I'm Mr. Black. Didn't have quite the same impact when sometimes you're going to say, what the hell?
Not really. Yeah, the central idea of your film has kind of been cut off at the knees. But based on Risky Business, which, you know, I think was made for something like $6 million and made something like $60 million, maybe just in the US or worldwide, but still a decent return on investment. You think Brickman would be, you know, have the world at his feet. It took him another 6 years to actually direct another movie. It was a bit of a drama called Men Don't Leave, starring Jessica Lange, which did zero business. And after that, he just vanished off the scene entirely. I'm not sure whether he did script doctoring work or anything like that. Apparently, I mean, I read an interview with him that was done a few years ago because he's quite reclusive now, apparently. He doesn't do a lot of interviews and all this kind of stuff. But he got on the line with this guy and he said, look, yeah, he was offered things. He was offered Rain Man, for instance, starring Risky Business star Tom Cruise, which was, I think, it was certainly the Oscar winner of its year, I think 1988, but also one of the biggest hits of the year as well. He was offered Forrest Gump. And this was just, these were the two high-profile titles. Eddie said he was offered hundreds of projects, but just didn't take them up on them. Now, he admits that... In his words, he doesn't dig visibility. He's more from the J.D. Salinger school. So he's someone who doesn't necessarily like being in the public eye. So maybe that's the case. But I mean, prior to Risky Business, he had a career as a screenwriter. He had a few produced scripts under his belt. He wrote a Bad News Bears sequel. He wrote a movie called Citizens Band, directed by the late, great Jonathan Demme. One that maybe stands out the most, and that doesn't really stand out that much because it wasn't much of a hit. In fact, it was probably a bit of a flop. It was called Deal of the Century. And it was a had the unique combination of elements, Chevy Chase and Sigourney Weaver starring, The Exorcist's William Friedkin directing, and Brickman writing. Now, this is not chocolate. You got chocolate and in my peanut
Hines
butter.
Gregory Hines, too.
And Gregory Hines as well. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Now, I watched it again just recently, tracked down a copy and had a look at it, and it's a real mess. It really is. But Friedkin is just the wrong guy for it. I mean, Friedkin is a fantastic action drama filmmaker, but comedy is not necessarily his strong suit.
No.
But you're listening to
abusing
the script,
or his cast, torturing and abusing his cast.
That too, yeah.
His strong suit. Yeah.
But you can see that Chevy Chase actually sort of knows what they're going for. I mean, it's a bit of a black comedy about arms dealers. And Chevy's sort of downplaying his usual comic buffoonery, playing a bit sort of doing a comic spin on Humphrey Bogart almost as a bit of a, anti-hero, works in the shadows kind of deal. And Brickman really adds a good bit of black comedy, taking the piss out of capitalism, all that kind of stuff. And I get the feeling he sort of explored that again in Risky Business. But as we were saying about Donnie Darko, the studio, I think it was Warner Brothers, got hold of, well, they saw what he was doing with Risky Business, said, it's a little bleak, it's a little dark, we like that Tom Cruise. Can you think he can actually get away with some of the stuff that he's pulling? And of course, he sort of does at the end. Yeah. So I think maybe that probably soured Brickman on Hollywood a bit. The fact that he had these great ideas. I mean, he calls Risky Business. Well, what he wanted to do was an exploration of the darker side of the lead character, Joel Goodson. Sort of have a darker tone to it. He said he was actually inspired by Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist, which is like, well, that's a bit highbrow, Paul. Jesus.
It's a bit of a weird thing that you had Night Shift in 1982, which was about two kind of ordinary guys starting a brothel in a morgue. And then a year later, you have Risky Business, which is about a college student. So, like, clearly that was it's Reagan's America, capitalism reigns. It's like the exploitation of women is untethered. I mean, I do remember Risky Business because you're right. It did sort of, it was marketed or at least put into that category of being like a teen sex comedy, like a Porky's or whatever, but had far more nuance and depth to it. But also, we're talking about Rearview Mirror, like Rebecca De Mornay, who sort of really did this and then The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. They're her two kind of most notable films, but she's so good in Risky Business and has like a real kind of presence. It's amazing that she, like, that made a star of Tom Cruise, but didn't really do the same for her.
That's the thing, there was almost a 10-year gap between Risky Business and The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, which is touted as a real comeback for her in, I think, about 92 or so. But it is odd, that she...
It might be a bit of the Tom Wilson syndrome in that, she played... she played a hooker or something, hooker with a heart of gold, and so she got typecast, or maybe she turned down certain roles. And then it is also, I think, speaks to the kind of sexism of casting in that, she was like the ingenue, and then 10 years later they cast her as the kind of bunny boiler,
It's absolutely,
like,
yeah.
She has no middle ground there, no depth, no nuance to, like, being a woman. It's like you have to be these specific archetypes to get employment.
It really is a shame because, she is toe-to-toe with Cruise in Risky Business and honestly probably stealing the movie from him. I mean, Cruise is still... Yeah. I mean, I think it's a pretty good performance by Cruise. He's not sort of... I don't think he'd worked out that he was Tom Cruise at that stage. I think he was still an actor. But he does a pretty good job playing a guy who's not necessarily the coolest dude on the block or the alpha male or anything like that. Joel's a bit of a loser.
Yeah, he's a dork. And she's very cool too. Like, that's a thing. Like, she has real street cred and attitude. She's a very cool customer. It's like, it's actually a great supporting cast because it's Curtis Armstrong's in it. Bronson Pinchot. And obviously Joey Pants as Guido.
Of course, Joey Pants. I'll tell you, one of the guys or one of the people that I was actually going to talk about on Whatever Happened To, he shows up in two Cruise movies. He's an actor named Bruce A. Young, and he's in The Color of Money as sort of this legendary pool hustler, Moselle, that Paul Newman and Tom Cruise sort of not run afoul of, but they cross paths with him. But in Risky Business, he plays Jackie, the transgender hooker.
Oh, yeah.
It's you know,
the first, the first calls up the escort agency. Yeah, that's the one that gets sent over.
Bruce Young is only in it for like maybe 3 minutes, but just has some, again, terrific presence, but just like, Joel, be a courageous person. Open the door. That way you see call a cab. It's beautiful line reading. It's just magnificent. I remember seeing Bruce A. Young in a couple of movies and thinking, this guy's got real just, he sort of leaps off the screen. And I think, he's one of those guys like Tom Wilson who's kind of worked steadily but never really broke all the way through.
I mean, guy, this kind of conversation keeps me up at night. And especially as like, you know, someone who's acted in some stuff as well. Like, I often will see, you know, a film will come on or I'll be scrolling through and I'll watch some film from 15 years ago and it'll be, you know, hypothetically, it's like a Will Smith vehicle and there's a guy playing his partner. And in my head, I'm like, I imagine the actor got that call from his agent saying, you are the second lead in a Will Smith film. And, you know, he would have called his family and he was high-fiving and he did this film and the film maybe was middling and it didn't really kick on for him. And now I'm watching it 15 years later on streaming. I'm like, who is this guy? But there would have been a moment when that actor got that call from his agent where his imagination would have exploded. Where he's like, this is it. Like, this is the start of the rocket ship for me. Well, but it doesn't happen for everyone. Yeah. That's why not everyone are stars.
It's happened just recently with another Tom Cruise movie with Top Gun Maverick. There's an actor named Manny Jacinto, who's on he's on that TV series The Good Place.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, and apparently he had like a sizable role as one of the flyboys, one of the pilots in Top Gun Maverick, and all the people who love The Good Place were like, oh man, he's in it, fantastic. And he was basically sort of cut out of the movie. He's only in it very, very briefly. So, you know, Manny was probably like, Top Gun Maverick, baby. You know, we made it 2 years ago, but it's coming out. Time for Manny to shine. And it's like, where the fuck is he?
isn't that the famous story about Kevin Costner? Like that he was cast in like four or five films in the lead roles that got cut every time. Like, I think he was meant to be in The Big Chill. I think he had a bigger part in Night Shift. There's all these films that Kevin Costner kept getting cut out of.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the only time you really see Costner in The Big Chill is the where his corpse is being dressed for his funeral. He's got the razor blade cuts in his wrist. That's all you see of Costner.
and I think in Night Shift, he's one of the frat boys when they have the first like frat party at the morgue. You see him walking behind Michael Keaton, like chanting chug, chug, chug or something. Like, all he had to do was write a film about dancing with a wolf and everything had changed from that point onward.
Yeah. Well, it happened to Adrian Brody as well, because apparently his character in the Terrence Malick war movie, The Thin Red Line, he was central. And then Malick being Malick and just like, no, I've got a different idea. I decided to make Jim Caviezel the star at most of Brody's scenes. Now, luckily, Brody went on to, you know, win an Oscar a few years later and all that kind of business. He's working right.
He's fine.
Jim Caviezel, in the meantime, has gone completely off the reservation. I don't know if you... He's 100% QAnon now.
Yeah, no, I have kept an eye on that. Well, that's actually a good segue to the next person I want to talk about. I know this is a favorite film of yours. It's definitely one of my all-time favorite films, which is Near Dark, Catherine Bigelow's vampire masterpiece of the late 80s. And there's an actress in it, Jenny Young, who plays May, the ingenue. Jenny Wright, who plays the vampire ingenue who lures Adrian Pazdar. Pazdar, how do you pronounce his name?
I think it's Pazdar.
Pazdar. And look, I think the strength of Near Dark, there's a lot of elements going in. It's clearly like Catherine Bigelow's eye. It's this amazing kind of ensemble cast. But she, Catherine Bigelow's eye for casting, you know, obviously with the vampire gang, that was easy for her to see because, you know, you just watch Aliens, just take all the great character actors from Aliens and put them in your film. And I think she was married or dating Cameron at the time. But she really cast Jenny Wright perfectly in this because she has this kind of sort of fragile, alluring quality. Like I think in the making of on the Blu-ray of Near Dark, you know, Catherine Bigelow talks about that moment where Adrian Pasdar sees her for the first time. It's this beautiful slow-mo under moonlight or street light at night, you know, and he's got to see her and fall in love with her instantly. And so she has this kind of quality. And the reason I sort of wanted to bring her into this equation is like, I think she's amazing in the role and stuff. And I didn't really sort of think about it too much. But when you watch the making of, like the entire Adrian Pasdar who they interviewed, they all are like, what are they? We don't even know where Jenny is. like what happened to Jenny? And so it kind of sent me on a bit of a rabbit hole. And so, look, she did work and has worked since Near Dark, mainly in sort of TV. But I found this GoFundMe page, which is a real journey. So she moved to the desert, essentially, bought like, you know, an acreage in the middle of the desert somewhere with her husband, who was an artist, and they were living off the grid. And like she's posted all these photos and stuff. Now, look, I'm not making light of this situation. It seems like it was a very bad situation. There's a bit of a domestic violence issue with this artist boyfriend slash husband of her, which she escaped. And so this GoFundMe is her sort of raising money. She wants to write a manuscript for a book to talk about her experiences. But I've been going through, so on the GoFundMe, she posts all these sort of updates. So this starts in like January 2016. And it is so bizarre because the things that she's posting, like the photos of the mobile home that they live in, you know, the desert where they live, it looks exactly like Near Dark. Like,
oh, if
you
think
about the way that family, you know, that vampire family, you know, they have this, it's kind of almost analogous to being like drug addicts, you know, they sort of live in this mobile home and they black out the windows and they've always got to stay on the move. They can't stay in one place for too long. It's that kind of a lifestyle that she brings in. And the last entry that she wrote was November 15th, 2016. And so she's the whole, all the way along, she's been posting these updates of, you know, this is where I met with my book and I'm writing about this experience and that experience. And she's getting all these lovely messages of support from fans of hers who have donated money. She's almost there. She's $1,000 short of her $7,000 goal. So if you want to support Jenny Wright, you can go find it and fund me.
Get in there, folks. Yeah.
Tell me this is not like this could be a sequel to Near Dark. She says, as I reflect on my experiences up on the mountain, I realize I must do much research on the dark art of necromancy and shapeshifting. There is so much that occurred that I do not understand yet. I do know that I laid myself bare to any sort of encroaching evil that might be near me. It was a poor Mexican mountain community, and I believe the attacks were not solely human, as perhaps
Holy
they
shit.
Got to David and he was a victim as well.
I'm going to crack open my super, get out $1,000 and send it to her so she can finish this manuscript. I want to read it based on this.
Yeah, I mean, nothing prior to that. Like all the other updates are fairly kind of normal. You know, it's just her talking about, yeah, she escaped this horrible abusive relationship and she's now, you know, living in the other side of the country and she's doing this and doing that. And then out of nowhere, the very last post is she believes that there's necromancy and shapeshifting and some kind of unexplainable evil that attacked them in Mexico. And I'm like, it's so weird. Like I was even, like I was scrolling through these photos going, this looks like it could be stills from a reboot of Near Dark.
It's I'm going to sound like a complete stalker here, but I'm actually Facebook friends with Jenny Wright. Not through any sort of legitimate friendship. I think it just came up one day as like, people you might know. And I was like, do you mean the Jenny Wright? Because I mean, I, of course, had a major crush on her in the 80s because of Near Dark. She was in a movie with Anthony Michael Hall called Out of Bounds. When old AMH tried to break out of the John Hughes nerd prison that had been created for him. And she was the love interest in that. It's not a very good movie. But I think she also has quite a, I'm going to sound like a right perv, a very memorable scene in the adaptation of The World According to Garp. sorry guys, she has a topless scene, and I'm like, and seeing that at age 13, I'm like,
it's the Pip and Tom scene. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, and like you, I mean, I'd seen the Near Dark special features, and yeah, Adrian Pasdar seemed really like
emotional.
If you're out there, get in touch, you know, because yeah, she always had that real fragility on screen. It was a sort of a beguiling combination of like, she seemed like a really street smart girl, but also bad shit had happened that, you know, there were cracks. There were cracks in the veneer or whatever. And I don't know, just I've found that fascinating. And yeah, when this sort of Facebook opportunity came up, I was like, oh yes, I'd like to be friends with Jenny Wright. And yeah, I was seeing a whole lot of those black and white pictures from the desert, and it's like, oh wow, it sounds like she's doing it tough, but she's getting out of it, and oh, that's good. So yeah,
Well, look, don't feel bad about your Facebook stalking, because when it comes to stalking the cast of Near Dark, I found out that Jeanette Goldstein runs a lingerie stop in East LA. And so I drove out to that lingerie store. I don't wear lingerie. I have never worn lingerie, but I drove out to that store specifically to meet Jeanette Goldstein. Like, and she was there. She was working. And so I bought some lingerie for Jen as a precursor, really, just to get to talk to her. And she could not have been nicer. She was cool as shit. Like, I think she must have picked it. Oh, he's another fucking nerd.
Yeah.
Who wants to talk about like aliens in Near Dark? But she was totally cool, man.
Had you auditioned for the Near Dark remake at that stage?
That's a good question. Did we talk about the Near Dark remake on a previous episode? Like,
I'm not sure if we talked about it on the episode. I'm sure you've talked. I think you talked about it with Justin Hamilton.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. It was like, the script was not good. They offered nothing new. But I don't know if I did bring it up to her. She was very cool, though, because the thing about Jeanette Goldstein is she, if you look at, you know, Vasquez and Diamondback, you know, and they're so different. She's actually this kind of, like, you know, Jewish, like East Coast American. She's nothing. She's such a great character actor. But she was more than happy to kind of talk about. I mean, I think she's amazing. I think she's like, talk about your rear views. Like, I think that in a just world, Jeanette Goldstein would be a huge star. Like, as versatile as like a Meryl Streep or anything like that, and as committed. But
or even if you want to be,
for whatever reason.
Yeah, even if you want to be just real reductive or simplistic about it, there's no reason why she couldn't have had the career that, say, Michelle Rodriguez had. I mean, you know, Vasquez is kind of the precursor to everything that Michelle Rodriguez does in the Fast and Furious franchise. And probably better, you know, honesty.
She actually told me about that. She said the issue with Vasquez was that people thought she was Hispanic. And so she was getting called into auditions as the tough Hispanic girl. And people were like, what? You're like, this Long like, Island
are you,
Jewish
Are you not
lady.
Seeing
like,
my name is Jeanette Goldstein?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, and she also has like a little cameo in Titanic as well. It's like a blink and you'll miss it.
She's holding her children as the
Irish immigrant. Like, she really is a phenomenal actress. Maybe I should have actually swapped out Jeanette Goldstein for Jenny right now that I think about it.
And she's got the T2 role as well, the Terminator 2 role.
Yeah, that's the thing. She maximizes screen time, Jeanette Goldstein. She does not waste a second that she's in front of the camera.
Very much so. All right, moving on to my next one, if that's all right.
Yeah, go.
I could easily fanboy about Jenny Wright and Jeanette Goldstein all day long. But instead, we'll go to another lady. Charlie, this may come as a shock, but I watched a lot of junk on video in the 1990s. But two things stick out specifically. There was one movie, they both involve, shall we say, ingenues. One movie I watched was Cyborg 2, Glass Shadow. which was one of the first appearances of a young actress.
Angelina Jolie.
Named Angelina Jolie. I thought, this girl's going places. Yeah, keep an eye on Angelina Jolie.
When I worked at Movieland in the mid to late 90s and Cyborg 2 came across my desk and I guess it was on the start of her ascent because they had made her front and center of that. I was like, I don't know who this actress is, but she's a star. I don't know if she can act, but if she looks like that and she can string two words together, she's going to be a star.
Now, it's funny you mentioned Ascent because one of the other things I watched was a movie called Dark Angel, The Ascent. which was direct-to-video, I think made somewhere in Eastern Europe. The plot is essentially the daughter of a demon down in hell is not enjoying hell. She's a typical teenager. She's like, oh, I want to go out and have fun. Oh, so she gets out of hell and comes up to Earth. And of course, this being a direct-to-video movie in the 1990s, the first time you see her, she's totally naked. This was a young actress named Angela Featherstone. Mm. And I looked at this young lady and said, Angela Featherstone's going places. She's going to be a star. Not quite on the level of Angelina Jolie, but Angie had not a bad 90s. I mean, certainly the latter half of the decade, you know, she was on Friends. I think she had a little bit of a run as a waitress that Ross has a fling with. She was on a Seinfeld.
No, she's the copy girl. She's the one who's like, Rossify it. When Ross and Rachel are on their first break, she's the girl that Ross sleeps with to ruin everything. Yeah.
She's in Con Air.
I'm just looking at Dark Angel, The Ascent, because I'm looking at the names of all these actors and like Constantin and Dragonescu, Christina Stoica, Constantin and Costamanis. And I'm like, where did they make this film? Turns out Romania.
But maybe she's best known for, she's the girlfriend in The Wedding Singer who dumps Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
And of course he writes the very Kill angry me. Love song. Yeah, very angry love song it's, about it.
That was the start of a repetitive theme in Adam Sandler comedies of the unappealing ex-girlfriend. Like it became a trope of Adam Sandler films that you would cast a sort of name or semi-name actress. There'd be one who'd be the hot, lovable one, and then there'd be the other one who's just like the shrew that you hated. And she was the kind of the pioneer of that trope. I think she's super funny in The Wedding Singer. She only has a few scenes, but she's got that real kind of hilarious, vapid lack of self-awareness, which I always think is a really funny quality for an actor.
Yeah. So, I mean, she's not without talent. She's got a striking look. I mean, Charlie, are you familiar with the term market correction? Have you ever heard this one?
No,
there are certain actors who will... Yeah. I think the best example that springs to mind right now is maybe you had Lindsay Lohan and then Emma Stone came along. It's like, oh, Emma Stone's doing everything that Lindsay Lohan can do, only better. And, you know, she's not drunk all the time. Sorry, that's a drivel thing to say about Lindsay Lohan. But I get the feeling Angela Featherstone, she sort of has the look, and you'll see it in other photos of her where she's a redhead in Dark Angel, but she's generally blonde, I think.
Mm.
I think Angela Featherstone walked so Margot Robbie could run 20 years later.
Right.
Sort of that look.
She's got a bit of Laurie Petty's about her too. That sort of tough, kind of tomboyish. You know, like when she's got the short hair, like she's got that kind of pretty tomboy kind of quality, don't you think?
Just enough androgyny to make you go, And I think, she had a good 90s, worked a little bit in the 2000s. And then sort of dropped off the scene a bit. And I think, okay, well, unfortunately, that's life in the big city. You know, not everyone has 3-4 decade runs. But I did a bit of research, and it turns out that Angela, prior to, you know, her success in Hollywood, was doing it pretty tough. I mean, you know, she had a fairly troubled past, included homelessness and a few cases of abuse and all this kind of stuff. She got herself emancipated when she was 17 and almost instantly became like a really successful model and then moved into acting. But once she started getting a bit successful, she couldn't really sort of keep the demons at bay. She was self-medicating a lot, all this kind of stuff. And she basically says that I literally threw all my money away at anyone who would take it. She was, and she's almost, she reverted to being homeless for a while because it almost felt comfortable to her. But a happy ending. She's doing quite now, apparently, as a writer. And she's also established a school for, and a sort of a school slash therapy facility for kids who are aging out of foster care, because that's her history as well.
Right. So that is a happy ending. I mean, you do look at her last few credits in IMDb, and it's like mental patient, homeless woman. It's like, yeah, fuck off, it's cruel.
That's true. And she worked with Australia's own Simon Baker a couple of times, though. She's in The Guardian and The Mentalist. So, I just found it funny that around the early 90s, I was like, all right, here are guys' picks for female stars of the 1990s, Angelina Jolie and Angela Featherstone. Of course, Angelina Jolie became Angelina Jolie, and Angela Featherstone, not quite as big, but apparently leading a fulfilling life now, which is good news.
I always think that Taylor Kitsch must look at Chris Hemsworth and be like, motherfucker, stole my career. Like, they both, Thor came out the same year as John Carter of Mars, and one has gone like that, and the other has gone like that. And it's like, I mean, they're both hunky dudes from TV backgrounds, and just one just got on that fucking Marvel gravy train, has never looked back, and the other one has just never quite had that vehicle. He was the big star on Friday Night Lights and just couldn't find the right vehicle. I mean, Tom Selleck really had the same issue, right? Like, you know, if Indiana Jones had come off, then who knows where he'd be now. But I'm sure he's doing fine, you know, selling reverse mortgages to people. Like,
shit. Well, I think Blue Bloods has been going for something like 10 years. So it's
I don't think he's short on cash, but it is one of those things where it's like, it's amazing, isn't it, that someone can be a big star on TV and you're like, oh, just they'll get the right vehicle. But it just proves it's harder than you think, you know?
Like, absolutely, yeah.
They get infinite bite to the cherry. I mean, Ryan Reynolds got infinite bite to the cherry before he finally did it himself with Deadpool. Like, they kept trying to make him a star. I mean, Jai Courtney a few years ago, they just kept trying to make Jai Courtney happen, and it just doesn't take off for whatever reason.
The longest running example of that for mine is Stephen Dorff.
Oh, yeah.
I think they first tried in like, I think he was like a child star or a child actor at least, but, you know, hit his late teens or whatever, and he was in the screen version of The Power of One.
Power of One, that's back
right. And it's like, oh, that's going to make him a star. And forgive me if I've talked about this before. I may have said this on when we've spoken in the past, but he did some interview for either Premiere or Movie Line magazine in the 90s, and he just sledged by name all his contemporaries. It's like, I'm reading this in Geelong, 1 million miles away from Hollywood, going, motherfucker, are you this dumb? And he's like saying, oh, yeah, Ethan Hawke, oh, look, I think he's a bit one note. Christian Slater, oh, Jesus, we had great Jack Nicholson impersonation. It's like, dude, you've got one movie under your belt. Yeah. I wouldn't be doing this. And it really did sort of kibosh his career for a while. But then every 7 years or so, they'll try to make him happen. You know, he got the lead in that Sofia Coppola movie where he's actually meant to be playing an A-list movie star.
Yeah.
And it's like, I see where you're coming from. And he's not bad. He can actually act and he's got some presence, but you know he's not A-list. And then, but then every once in a while he'll sort of, you know, make another comeback. He was in the third season of True Detective and did a really good job. And off the back of that, he got a series and that series got canceled after like one season. So it's like, we really want to make this guy happen, but people just aren't biting, or they're not taking a big enough bite.
I know we talked about this in a previous episode about Billy Zane, but that's I always feel like Billy Zane was in that category as well. Like, Billy Zane never slagged anyone off, but you know, around the late 90s with Phantom and, you know, playing the lead villain in Titanic, it's a really good platform, and he's a good actor. Like, I don't think you can argue that he's not a good actor, but then he sort of just has seemed to got stuck in what you would, you know, once upon a time called direct-to-video. Hell, I'm not sure if you're watching The Boys at the moment, but he plays himself in
the
late series of The Boys, because they open by basically taking the piss out of himself as this B-movie actor. Like, if you're going to make a knockoff or a cheap sequel, then Billy Zane's your guy. And I'm like, I get it, and I'm glad he's got a sense of humor about it, but it does kind of make me go, oh, Billy was my guy. Like, I always thought that, Billy Zane should have been a bigger star.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember seeing him in Dead Calm back in 89 or whatever. It's like,
he's awesome.
Holy shit, this guy's fantastic. I mean, he's beautiful. He looks like young Brando.
Yeah, and he's, exactly.
And he's doing some, you know, weird villainy shit that's like, you've been watching Christopher Walken or the guys like that. I mean, you're trying to throw a few odd wrinkles into it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it is, and this is very superficial, and I can say this as a bald man. it's the hair. The fact that he had the early receding hairline and he just decided to shave it all off. And his bald head didn't look quite as good as, say, John Malkovich's or Bruce Willis's or something like that. I think that may have something to do with it.
Yeah, you think
He needs to be in a Marvel movie.
Plugs. Mm. A what?
He needs to be in a Marvel movie. He needs to be like one of those Jeff Goldblum or Benicio del Toro
Reckon a Tarantino could revive. And I could see those two gelling really well. Like, I think that in the right kind of role, I think that Billy Zane would excel in the world of Quentin Tarantino. I just think he has something about him. And Tarantino does kind of tend to lean towards those B-movie guys. Like, that's, you know, true. He likes to kind of like elevate them. So I could imagine a film in which Tarantino elevates Billy Zane, just gives him a role, or, like, you know, just a cameo. Or
a Wes Anderson movie. I reckon it'd be very, very, very good in the Wes Anderson universe.
I think he's good at comedy. I think he's good at comedy. Yeah. I don't know how this turned into the Billy Zane podcast, but let's move on.
Billy Zane is a cool dude.
He's a cool guy. You should listen to him. I've saved a filmmaker that I love, but I can't really explain why I love this guy. Having read recent reports about his private life, it's a bit icky. But I'm talking about
it's Shane Woody Carruth. Allen. Oh,
yeah. I'm talking about Shane Carruth, who directed two films, Primer and Upstream Color. Now, Primer, most people will know as the most realistic time travel film, which is such a fucking garbage line, because it's not. Time travel is impossible, does not exist. There's no such thing as
it's realistic time travel.
All they do in that is they use very authentic sounding engineering type and scientific dialogue, and they don't dumb it down. So that's why I think people go, like, oh, it's realistic. I don't understand it. So, you know, it's like Homer Simpson watching Twin Peaks and going, I have no idea what's going on, but it's brilliant. But you cannot argue that the guy has really good taste. He has a specific point of view and good taste. Like, Primer is a really, I love it. I think it's such a fascinating, enthralling film. Like, you can tell it's made for 10 grand or whatever it's made for. But it's just such a, I remember I sat with my mate Nick and we got out a big bit of butcher's paper and we tried to sketch out all the timelines and the looping timelines of Primer and got totally confused. And then when Upstream Color came out, because my wife, Jem, she's also a big fan of his. And so we were so excited to go see Upstream Color. And I've seen it, I think, maybe three times now, and I still don't know what it's about. I've absolutely no idea what he's trying to say. But I love that he wants to say it, and I think the films look amazing. Like, even the, you know, the cheap beta cam of Primer, there's a definite specific point of view. And I even went so far as I knew my local revival cinema when I was living in Sydney, when Looper came out, they did all this publicity about, oh, Shane Carruth was like, you know, the special consultant to Ryan Johnson. And so they did this screening of Upstream Color at my local cinema, and then they did a chat with Shane Carruth like via satellite, and I was in the audience. And so I asked a question about that. I was like, "Hey, man! Like, I heard that you were a consultant on Looper. So, what did that consist of?" And he's like, "Ah, it's gone. That's such bullshit. It's gone. Like, Ryan Johnson asked me to read the script, and so I read it. I didn't even really have any notes. But then from that, they used my name as some kind of like, because I guess that they knew that Prime would had add this some reputation. Yeah, that would give it some kind of credence." But I just read an interview with Shane Carruth prior to these domestic violence allegations by his ex-wife or ex-girlfriend, which are horrible. But he did one of the most scorched earth interviews. Like, you're talking about Stephen Dorff just plotting it, where he basically he executive produced The Wanting Mare, which is a sci-fi film that came out last year that got great write-ups. I think it went to Sundance. I haven't seen it yet. I've been trying to see it, but it's not available anywhere in Australia yet. He executive produced that, and then he did this interview where he was just like, fuck Hollywood, fuck everything about this place, fuck these arrogant writers and fucking arrogant directors and fucking actors. Like, he really... he doesn't name anyone specifically, but Hollywood as a system, he's like, I've just got better things to do with my time than beg idiots, you know, for money. And then he is talking about how cinemas that show Marvel movies and art house movies as if they're the same thing. They're not. Like, one is pure junk, and the other thing is someone trying to say something. And it's a really fascinating interview, but I'm convinced he's not coming back. Like, when you read this, like, this sounds like a guy who's like, fuck this, I'm never coming back, which is sad because I know he had a film that was meant to go into production with Keanu Reeves about, like, trade routes or, like, like a shipping drama about 8 or 9 years ago. And he attached quite a good cast, but then nothing ever came of it. And then, the next thing was, fuck everyone, I'm out of here.
Yeah, well, it was called The Ocean something or The Something Ocean or whatever.
See if I can find it.
Yeah, but I remember hearing about that and there was a lot of, if you thought his previous two things were good, this is the thing this is what'll kick him up a notch. Or this is what'll make it worse.
He actually talked about that in this interview. He said that after Primer, it was kind of like the Richard Kelly thing where everyone said to him, oh man, like, you know, this is the ladder for you. You're going to do this and this. And he believed it. And he was like, okay, well, that's what I'll do. But then he just got so disenfranchised with the studio system and the games he had to play and having to convince people. Because, I mean, he's quite a remarkable story, really, when you think that he's a guy who came from a completely, like, didn't go to film school or anything, just made this film for no money with his friends, and then it got all these great write-ups, and then he decided that I'm going to be an actor, and so he's actually, like, got more acting credits than he has as a writer or a director. Like, he's done a couple of TV shows, Tales from the Loop, did a couple episodes of that in 2020, had a lead role in a film called The Dead Center, which is kind of like a psychological thriller that I haven't seen yet. But I think he obviously just is someone who was never really drawn into the Hollywood system. Like, his ambition his ambition did not match the sacrifices or the shit eating he was going to have to do in order to become, you know, what his agents were sort of hoping he was going to become.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I've seen Primer a few times. I've got it on disc here, and you're right. I don't get it. I mean, but it's one that I want to get, and that's what keeps drawing me back to it. There's enough. It gives me just enough that I'm like, I'm really close. and likewise with Upstream Color. I mean, I've only seen that once, but I do have a copy around here and do want to watch it again. Because, I remember sitting through and going, it's exactly like Homer Simpson. Like, this is brilliant, but I've got no idea. But he's clearly got a lot of really big ideas that either I'm too dumb to pick up on, or he's not 100% successful in expressing, but he's also such a great technician / artist that it's just a pleasure to sort of watch his movies. Upstream Color in particular is, it's like watching some weird undiscovered Russian masterpiece or something. It's
You know what he reminds me of is a bit like, we've talked about Jeff Nichols. He's like a more art house Jeff Nichols, same sort of same technical competence and themes and stuff, but much more esoteric, I guess, than Jeff. Jeff Nichols seems to be more grounded in reality with little, flourishes of high concept. Whereas,
look, in you go back 20 years, and Jeff Nichols is just a run-of-the-mill mainstream filmmaker. I mean, Jim, he's an arty guy, but at the same time, he's a fairly mainstream guy.
Mm.
I mean, I think, to the best of my understanding, if we may have talked about this in the past, he really wanted to work in the mainstream. He was really sort of pitching big projects to Warner Brothers. I think he actually made Midnight Special, one of my favorite movies the last 10 years, as evidence, or sort of like proof of concept. It's like, I can do mainstream thriller action whatever with a bit of a sci-fi fantasy bent. I think he was really, he wanted to be in the running to do Aquaman. He was coming up with concepts of that, and of course Midnight Special didn't make any damn money, which is such a shame because it's such a good movie.
It's funny. I watched the opening scene of that just about 2 weeks ago, just because I wanted to remind myself, and it's fucking brilliant. Like, talk about economic storytelling. What they establish in that first 2 minutes of that film, exactly what's at stake, who the main characters are, what the obstacles are, what their goal is. Like, it's brilliant. It's really genuinely brilliant filmmaking.
Yeah. All right. Well, shall we go from the sublime to the somewhat ridiculous?
To the indecipherable? Yeah, let's do it.
All right. I'm going to close out my trio of rearview mirror personalities and actors with Olivier Gruner. Now, who was Olivia Gruner, you may ask, and you'd be justified in doing so, because the 80s, foreign muscle men who could kick your butt were Hollywood gold. You know, if you found one and you shaped it just right, yeah, you were raking in that money, baby. Schwarzenegger, of course, is the alpha male of this, but then you've got Van Damme as well. And then below Van Damme, you've got a few more. You know, people were clearly trawling the dojos of Europe to find...
There was a plethora of Americans. You had like your Dudikoffs and your Dacascuses and, you know, all of those kind of guys. But if you wanted to give it, I guess, the thinking was it gives you greater international sales or something like that?
Quite possibly, yeah. I mean, that's a really good point, Charlie. It's probably the case. But Olivier Gruner is a French gentleman. He came from a family of, well, his father was a very well-renowned surgeon. One of his brothers did likewise. One of his brothers became an engineer. Olivier just wanted to fight. He just wanted to kick butt. So from a very early age, he was studying martial arts. And when he hit 18, he joined the French military and became a literal fucking commando. So he was in the military for a while. He's, you know, buffing up and he's learning his killing skills there. Then he decides to become a professional kickboxer. By 1986, he is the world middleweight kickboxing champion. By 1987, he retires from the game, goes to the Cannes Film Festival, and gets, quote-unquote, discovered. Now, Olivier Gruner, handsome gentleman, French accent, built like a brick shithouse, can't act worth a lick.
Terrible.
But he was the star of a sci-fi actioner, cyberpunk thriller that I really loved in the early 1990s called Nemesis. Total Blade Runner knockoff, made for the change he found in the back of the couch. He does some wonderful kick-ass work in it, you know, with his martial arts, etc. Also, you know, looks very capable firing a gun. They gave him the voiceover. They gave him the Rick Deckard-style narration.
Oh, no.
They shouldn't have done it.
Is it actually his voice?
But nonetheless, there's some... It is, yeah. Because here's the thing. This is more than you ever want to know about the 1992 sci-fi thriller Nemesis.
No,
but I remember watching it on DVD. On VHS. And one of the actresses who has this lovely, smoky, femme fatale kind of voice does the narration. I was like, this is really good. Yeah, and she's kind of a pivotal character. This works a treat. For some reason, I have owned 4 or 5 different iterations of Nemesis as it's been upgraded over time. So now I have it on Blu-ray. And I put in the Blu-ray and then it starts and I'm expecting to hear this this narration by this actress. And instead I go, life is tough in the future. It's like, what the fuck?
So, looking at this cast list, see, Thomas Jane and Jackie L. Haley. So, I mean, you know, you've got some Oscar caliber talent working on this.
I think it's one of Thomas Jane's like first roles and he's like completely butt naked for the most part. Jackie Earle Haley is in it for approximately 5 seconds. This is in between his Bad News Bears breaking Away days and his comeback in Watchmen and all that a little later on. So he's kind of in the wilderness at this stage. But the great Tim Thomason of Future Cop fame is in there and a few others. Nemesis is... It's good junk. It's junk, but it's good junk. But it's you know, led by this absolute lummox. And I'm always really interested in like the second and third act of, as with actresses, as with starlets like Jenny Wright or Angela Featherstone, the muscle guys. You know, I mean, I think they have a bit more of a path into a later career. I mean, as you've seen by they've made 4 Expendables movies. Well, the fourth one's coming out later this year. And, you know, every well-known actor worth their salt, if they can walk without a Zimmer frame and they're in their 60s or 70s, like, let's put a gun in their hand and, you know, maybe this could be their Taken. So, but martial arts guys, I don't think they normally really do that much. So I wanted to see what Olivier was doing these days. And, well, yeah, after a career that involved titles like Mercenary, Interceptors, Interceptor Force 2, and TNT, he's moving behind the camera and directing things like Sector 4, Extraction. So, but according to his website, because he's 62 years old now, let's see, quote unquote, Olivier has many plans for the future.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
what they actually entail. I don't know. Yeah. But, you know, if you make an Expendables 5 or even an Expendables knockoff that has the guys who aren't famous enough to be in the Expendables, like Dudikoff or whatever, like, you know, get the American Ninja guy and get Olivia Gruner in there.
It's funny, too, like, because action films kind of changed in the 90s. I remember actually Sly Stallone talking about it, and he said that he knew, like, action movies were in trouble when the first Batman, Tim Burton's Batman, came out and Michael Keaton was in that muscle suit. Because now he's like, oh, well, you don't actually need to be a big guy. Like, they can just, you know, make it happen with costumes and CGI. And then I think The Matrix was the next nail in the coffin, because it's like, well, if you just take any cast away and just train them for 6 months, you can make anyone look like a martial artist or an action star. I mean, I think that sort of changed the game as well, because it's like, oh, so you can actually, because it used to be you had to make a choice, right? You get a good actor who doesn't know how to do action, or you get like a martial artist who can't fucking act. But now you can take away like Lawrence Fishburne and teach him how to do a roundhouse kick, and all of a sudden you got the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah. Well, like we said when we talked about Bruce Willis in that episode, he was the he was equidistant between the two of them. He was the actor who could convince as an action hero. But yeah, I mean, from the late 90s onwards, it was like, well, yeah, you know, with a bit of wire work, a little bit of CG, but also a lot of training. Yeah, Keanu is very convincing in The Matrix. Or, you know, Matt Damon has clearly, you know, been hitting the gym and been working with a trainer, and now he's convincing as Jason Bourne. But before that, it was like, oh, yeah, we'd better get Arnold in, because, you know, no one would believe otherwise that any of our leading men could actually kick this much ass.
The weirdest one in recent memory was when Adrian Brody got buffed for Predators.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, he's all like shirtless and shit. And I'm like, I don't know. I like this Adrian Brody. I like nerdy, tortured Adrian Brody. I don't like shirtless, I'm a commando Adrian Brody. Doesn't work.
Yeah. And he didn't really need to do it, did he? Because, I mean,
didn't need to be shirtless at all. He's fighting an alien. Like, having muscles doesn't.
No. It's like, as roided up as you are. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Predator's still going to beat you in a fist fight. But for the bulk of that movie as well, he's like, this is actually a really neat twist that he's not, you know, a muscle-bound Superman. He's actually more of a sort of a lean, mean, you know, guy who sort of like survives in war zones by his wits and grit and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, then at the end, it's like, better show you guys I've been working out.
Yeah.
It's like, I always that's think impressive, too, but you're right. It's like, man, I don't know.
Hot Shots 2, when Charlie Sheen got really buff for Hot Shots 2. Oh, and it's like, are you the first like actor in a like a screwball spoof comedy to have gotten like super jacked?
That was so unusual, wasn't it? Yeah.
All right, Guy, thank you so much for coming back on the show, stepping into the video store. If you want to hear Guy talk about The Simpsons, you can. He has a podcast called Four Finger Discount. I'll put a link in the episode description below. Where can people find you on Twitter?
You can find me at Robert Guy Davis. Yes, dispensing what I'm watching tonight, and
I love it. A Guy Davis update is fantastic. I get excited when I see you going, especially if it's late at night, because I know I'm going to get some real interesting observations.
Late at night is what I'm watching. During the day is, Jesus Christ, this is pissing me off.
I know you do. It's like silly, and you love to rail against writers. You love to rail against writers who either do like revisionist histories of films that absolutely suck and cannot be revived, or just the pithy statements, the pithy clickbait headlines. You fucking, that's a bugbear of yours, isn't it?
Not a fan. Charlie, thank you so much for having me back on board, welcoming me into the video shop. It's always, always, always a pleasure.
I'm Charlie Clausen.
I'm Guy Davis.